Bradley Basker. Stats Adam.
Live from the Kmart Studios here at Washington University in St. Louis, Bedtime Sports with Brad and Brad. Brad Lewis is away this week again.
Playoff? Let's win a game.
Hi, Dr. Jeff here.
What's up, Milo?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Join the Facebook page, Bedtime Sports with Brad and Brad.
It's Bedtime Sports with Brad and Brad, with Brad and Stats Adam.
Oh, welcome to a March 7th Friday here on the Washington University campus. This is Adam Lowenstein, Stats Adam. Here is your main co-host with a special replacement for Mr. Bradley Basker, who is off this week. He might be calling in later on, but we do have a special co-host who I will go right to right away. I know he has a lot to talk about with everything that has to do with New York sports as well as everything around the world and a little bit of boxing as well. We have Milo Papadopoulos. How you doing, Milo?
I'm doing great, Stats. How you doing?
Yeah, doing all right. Just, it definitely feels weird to be in the studio as Alex is kind of just hanging out here, but no Brad. Alex, you don't have to leave. No, I was just setting up the scene here, just giving them a little look at what this new place looks like. Just the idea that it kind of feels a little weird doing it over the phone. This is the first time in a while, I think, that we've had no Brad or no Brad in the studio for a while. But it's great to have Milo on and doing pretty well. How are you doing, Milo?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be on the air with you. Happy to enjoy life and talk about sports.
Glad to hear it. Enjoying life, yes. And you know who's not really enjoying life is your New York Knickerbockers. I know they're looking at a interesting situation with Phil Jackson. It was recently reported that it was a few weeks ago that they were trying to get him on as head coach. How would you feel as Mike Woodson or in this whole situation? What do you think this situation presents for the New York Knickerbockers?
Yeah. Well, if you've seen a Knicks game lately, you know, it's sort of you have to, you know, concentrate for a minute as to whether or not you've turned on a Knicks game or you've turned on the latest episode of The Walking Dead. Because they're so lacking in energy and unenthusiastic, and they really have the look of a team that's just given up and is shambling through the rest of the season, despite their win against Minnesota last game, and definitely needs something. This season is shot, and it's really just been like an alternate universe. And the things that have gone wrong are HBO drama. The different things that have happened this season between Andrea Bargiani having a season-ending injury. Their starting point guard, Raymond Felton, who really has never gotten any press for any off the court behavior, being arrested for threatening his wife with a firearm and facing possible jail time, just cutting ties with two off-season acquisitions. But as far as Phil Jackson goes, this is the Knicks and MSG and the Dolans in particular have this long history of sort of pining after missed opportunities. They interviewed Phil Jackson 2 years ago before Mike Woodson was given the offer. If I'm not mistaken, he wasn't interested in the team then. And I don't see why anything would have changed. It's just more, I think, sports tabloid scuttlebutt. No one could blame the Knicks for seeking a replacement for Mike Woodson during this season, and he certainly bears some of the blame. But the thing is, the expectations for the Knicks, building on their playoff series win last season and making it at least another round and being a contender with Miami and Indiana in the Eastern Conference was high. And with an older expensive team, you can sort of see disaster in the making there. So as far as talking to Phil Jackson, I think they were just talking. I wouldn't worry about it, even if I were Mike Woodson, because I don't think that's serious. I don't know why Phil Jackson would want to put himself in that position. His reputation for the way he coaches is really completely inconsistent with the culture of the Knicks and the New York sports mentality. So I just think he concluded a long time ago, despite being a member of the Knicks' 1970 and 1973 championship teams, that wasn't a job that he wanted to stick his neck out for.
Yeah, what an interesting full circle situation that would be if he went around and came back to New York as a coach. I find it very interesting that obviously his wife is, or his girlfriend, we have no idea what Jeannie Buss and Phil Jackson, do we know the exact, is it girlfriend? With Jeannie,
I'm not sure.
But the connection between Phil Jackson and Jeannie Buss is a very strong one, and the Lakers and Knicks both kind of struggling in both their conferences this season would be just kind of interesting if he ended up going to New York to add on to that interesting just dynamic between the two teams that are arguably the two most famous teams in the league. And as far as the Dolans that you had mentioned, I was just talking with Alex on his show covering the bases about Malcolm Gladwell interviewing Adam Silver about the Dolans. As far as Silver going forward, he was just completely bashing him about the MSG situation, in which how they have so many tax breaks. And I think this is the first year they've actually paid their electric bill in many years. I don't know if you had anything that you had to say about that situation in New York, other than, you know, with the on-the-court product.
Well, I mean, the conventional wisdom among fans, I don't have any insight as to, you know, their accounting practices. We just know how their decisions affect the Knicks and the Rangers and to a lesser extent, the Liberty. And now there's the fourth MSG franchise, Billy Joel, which I don't think the Dolans have much to do with. but they certainly have made a strong case. If you look at the last 20 years, since the Rangers won the Stanley Cup and the Knicks made the finals in the same year, they certainly have made a strong case for a tremendously incompetent ownership tradition of simply impulse buying anything that looks shiny and new, and even when they do make what looks like paper, looks like a good decision on paper, they sort of don't have the patience to see it through. Rookies with potential that seem to be diamonds in the rough that they found that were unheralded wind up getting traded before the end of their first season, and usually make a contribution with the teams they get traded to. There's a player, I'm blanking on his name, but he was traded to the Lakers and on Indiana, who was a second round pick and really they could have used for this entire stretch, has really become a valuable small forward on different organizations. And they just don't see the investments in young talent through, and they just go after big contracts and are perpetually in the salary cap situation. When they first signed Amari Stoudemire, he really made the franchise matter again. But when you did the double max contract albatross with Carmelo, you knew the whole last 3 years of this would tie their hamstrings. But perhaps the biggest problem they have is they don't think twice about trading away draft picks. the Knicks could be the lottery pick this year, but they traded their lottery pick to Denver in the Carmelo Anthony trade, and so they don't have that. They've just got a second round draft pick, and they perpetually since the 1990s have traded away the draft picks that could form the foundation for the franchise. What I think has to happen is there has to be more of a strong use of the D-League as really more of a true farm team system. And I think it's going to take some changes for that to happen. One of the things that's crazy is when the NBA Players Union negotiates their salaries, they couldn't care less about the D-League, and so they wind up making like $24,000 a year, which is not enough for them to keep them out from playing in Europe and making much more money if they don't make the NBA. If the players would invest in the future as well, you could pay more reasonable salaries to the D-League players. It might stop them from moving on and not being available when they just need a little bit more seasoning.
And the great thing about the Knicks for their situation is that they have their own D-League team. And if they go with Mark Cuban's idea of trying to bring these top-level recruits into the D-League, which has a minimum age of 18, you have the possibility of being able to farm up and bring in guys who actually can contribute at a young age. I know you're looking at a guy in Tim Hardaway Jr. right now who I'm surprised hasn't been traded yet because of his amazing success as a young guy on the team that could bring in a veteran that the Knicks want. So being able to take the Erie BayHawks and being able to make them into some type of team that would resemble, you know, the Mets, you know, AAA team or some type of AAA type of thing in baseball, bringing over to basketball, that it's definitely a topic that's been really talked about a lot recently. I think even they, you know, mentioned a little bit at the Sloan Sports Conference last week about the idea that, you know, when Cuban was all over that, even though he wasn't actually at the conference himself, but he has just been just a proponent as far as new measures in the league, and he's always in the forefront. So I think it would just be great to see if the Knicks could take advantage of that, because you're right, trading away draft picks is pretty much the exact opposite of what you want to do for a team that continues to get older every year, and we don't even know if Melo's coming back next year. Do you want Melo on this team next year? Is that a possibility in which you can't even fathom? You have to actually have him because there's no other way to build the team with all these just random veterans and a few little, you know, young guys.
Yeah. Well, the overall, it's a better team with Carmelo Anthony on there. And we know he's got some personal reasons for not wanting to go to other places other than big market teams like the Bulls and the Lakers. I don't expect to see him, and possibly the Heat, just because they've got so much juice in the LeBron James era. But I just don't see him playing in Oklahoma City next to Kevin Durant next year. I just don't think that's in his lifestyle interests. The big plus to Carmelo leaving or opting out at the end of the season is that it'll just remove a max contract from the cap room. But that's ultimately a poor plan. So I think the Knicks should make reasonable efforts to retain him. But what they should not do, which might be the worst scenario, is commit to a new 5-year max contract in order to keep him. I mean, that's the big problem from this organization is they don't learn from their mistakes. So that would not be a good idea. I think it's about 50-50 as to whether or not he's a Knick next year.
It's just a very intriguing thing because you're looking at a draft in which it could basically it could change the NBA with the number of prospects who are coming into the league in the next year or so, you know, depending on how many people want to come out of the college freshman class this year, and then a few of the older, I guess we call them veterans now, the sophomores and juniors in college. You know, that the draft is looking so good that, you know, is it possible that, you know, teams could, you know, move on? But I don't know if the Knicks are going to be able to do that. You're, as you said, with the, you know, misplacement of their draft pick from a previous trade for, of course, Melo. We're going to go to a public service announcement, and then we can continue talking a little about the NBA and move on to some other sports topics as well.
Money, don't rely on luck. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering in. For free ideas on how to save, go to feedthepig.org.
All right, there we go. So, you know, we were just talking about the Knicks. As far as, you know, going forward, do you think they have any chance? I think this will be the last question on the Knicks. Do you think they have any chance of making the playoffs whatsoever this year in the weak Eastern Conference. They're 5.5 out right now.
Yeah, well, they're 5.5 out. I mean, there's a slim chance. I don't see this group of guys juicing themselves up, we refer to adrenaline, not anything performance enhancing, and making a real run. They've had several 5-game runs, and then they usually follow those 5-game wins up with 5 or more losses right after that. So you sort of wonder what goes on there. I could conceive of them putting themselves in a better position than they are, but it would really take the Hawks or Charlotte having a real decline. They would need help. I think it's fair to say that much like an NFL team that needs to win and needs 3 other teams to lose on the last day of the season to be a wild card, the Knicks don't control their own destiny. They need to get their act together for a run, but they also need the seventh and eighth seeds right now to falter. And if they did make the playoffs, where are they going to go against Indiana, who presumably is going to be the number one seed at this point? Nobody would be surprised if they squeaked into the playoffs and then had a sweep. What I would say about the playoff format, and I don't know if we've brought this up on the show in the past, you look, and I think for probably 12 of the last 15 years, there are teams in the Western Conference with winning records that miss the playoffs, and teams in the Eastern Conference with losing records that make it. And you know, it's just been this disparity that's gone on for nearly a generation, with a couple of years of exceptions. It would be hard to say who's the Eastern Conference champion if you did this, but I would advocate that all of the division winners are automatic seeds, and then everyone else is a wild card, regardless of what conference they're from. And the only problem would be you could have two teams that compete in one conference being in the finals. But nevertheless, if you look at the standings, I think there's a team that Memphis is 34-26 with a .567 winning percentage. Okay, that would be the number 3 seed in the Eastern Conference right now. All right, and they may miss the playoffs. So at least they still have it in their own hands because they're only a game out of the eighth slot. This kind of disparity has existed for a while. I have no hopes that's really what's going to happen, because they're not going to muck with the formula that much. That would be a change I'd be in favor of.
What's interesting is, and I'll go a little bit into Adam Silver's idea for a little mini type of NCAA tournament esque thing, for the eighth or seventh seed, which could be expanded to at least complement some type of idea that would give you the opportunity to give more teams that are better the opportunity to get in the playoffs. But first, I just wanted to just touch on something about winning streaks. By the way, no team except for the Brooklyn Nets has won more than two straight games. I'm sorry, more than one straight game in the Eastern Conference. Everybody in the Eastern Conference has either a losing streak or a win streak, I don't even know if you can call it a win streak, but has only won their last game, has not won the previous game. So the only win streak in the Eastern Conference is the Brooklyn Nets. It's crazy. But as far as what Silver was talking about, he likes the idea of having that little randomness idea, especially for a team that's most likely going to get bounced out in the first round, as you mentioned with the Knicks, if they do make the eighth seed. Why not, if you take what you're talking about with the playoff format, why not take a situation in which you have, let's say, the bottom 3 seeds of each of the conferences, and then you take, or and I think you can actually mesh them together. You can make it into a wild card, like you were talking about. So you end up taking, after the first 3, you can even do for the divisions, everybody else plays a tournament in which the teams that win, it would be single elimination, and the teams that are left, whatever 4 or 5 teams or 8 teams that you have left, are in the playoffs in that order. you know, in the record order after eliminating other teams. You could do some type of single elimination in which you get rid of some teams kind of at the end of the season, or even during the All-Star break, you could do like some type of elimination tournament for a few of the teams that are near the bottom. I don't know. There are so many different possibilities in which you could actually bring together these conferences and not have to worry about, you know, the worst teams, like these awful teams like the Pistons and the Cavaliers, who might even have a chance at the playoffs. It just, there's so many possibilities. At least giving the Western Conference a few chances at getting into the playoffs would be nice, even in a single elimination tournament.
Yeah, one possibility, and I don't know of any sport that's done this league-wide and not kept conferences apart, but you could have the equivalent of a playoff game, a play-in game, like you have in the NCAA tournament, between the teams with the top two records that just don't make the playoffs. Obviously, for numerical purposes, you would need two such games for it to make any sense. We saw in Major League Baseball, they had the one-game wild card play-in. Which I think needs to be expanded to three games, and I think I've talked about that on the show before.
Yeah.
At least it addresses the issue of if you have the three best teams in baseball in one division, the third place team in a strong division, which has a better record than two divisional champions in another division, is shut out. That something like this might address a team with a 567 winning percentage from the Western Conference in the NBA not being shut out of the playoffs.
Yeah, there's so many possibilities, and there's so many things that – and Silver's already made so many different changes that have kind of gone under the rug, the idea of giving every team the ref mistakes. Anytime a ref makes a mistake, they're going to know about it. The team will the day afterwards, so they actually can know what exactly is going on and how they're actually critiquing the referees in the league. There are many different possibilities of things. One other thing that Adam Silver's trying to do is actually move up the age. I was talking about the D-League before, a little bit about the 18-year-old situation in which Mark Cuban is trying to institute a separation between the NCAA and the D-League and actually trying to bring high school players into the D-League. That may change if they want to bring up the minimum age of the NBA. What's your opinion of bringing up the age in the NBA to 20 and then maybe the further ramifications of what the D-League will have to entail as well?
Yeah. Well, my opinion of bringing up the minimum age for either the NBA or the D-League, and I may be in the minority here, but I would not be in favor of that because, and you and I have seen it up close, in 2010 we saw a non-scholarship Ivy League Cornell team play in the Sweet 16 against a Kentucky team that featured John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins, Patrick Patterson, Eric Bledsoe, and I think the backup power forward wound up being a first round pick also. Orton was his name.
Was Daniel Orton?
Daniel Orton, yeah. And what you realize when you see that is that and there was some press about them not really being players, but what you realize is that these individuals are not in college to get an education. They are in college to showcase their features for the NBA draft and to earn the colleges they attend millions and millions of dollars, none of which they get based on the college publicity. But someone like John Wall capitalized on it in the NBA draft. When you have high profile athletes like this, who are in college that are expected to go in the NBA draft, and there's not a huge number of them. That's what we're talking about is the ones who are going to be one and done, and now it sounds like it's going to be two and done if Adam Silver gets his way. These are not at these institutions to get a college education, it's like a running joke. It's got about the same credibility as when I was a kid when when people still used to pretend that professional wrestling was not rigged. You know, we all know that they're not in college to get an education that they can use to serve them later in their lives. And of course, there are exceptions. There are great examples like Juwan Howard going back and finishing his degree at the University of Michigan on time, despite being drafted as a freshman out of the NBA. But there are rare exceptions to the rule. So I think enough with the pretense. If someone is an adult, if they can vote, if they can taxes, then they should be able to choose signing with the NBA before playing in college, and not just sitting in college for a year. Now, the assigning them to the D League until a certain age, you know, that's if you go with my argument there, then they should have the right to earn their rookie money right away. But I'd still be in favor of jacking up the D League salaries to make it more of an attractive real farm system. I mean, all farm systems, it's a huge problem with the Major League Baseball farm systems is that they barely make, you know, a lot of times the lower leagues don't, rookie league and short season A and long season A don't even make minimum wage for the amount of time they spend on the job. So this is endemic of all minor leagues.
Oh, absolutely. It's crazy. And the most frustrating thing is the 10-day contract in which, you know, what, 5% of the players who go from the D-League to the NBA are able to sneak in there. Or, you know, over a few years, you're able to get a few minor contracts in there. But, you know, not too many players hold on. I know with the Celtics, we've watched Chris Johnson, you know, blossom as a bench guy. But he's on a team, a Celtics team, that's floundering, like, you know, similar to, you know, I wouldn't say the same situation as the Knicks, but a team that has taken on guys who, you know, are not going to contribute as well and or might not be on the team in the following year. The Knicks and Celtics might have completely different teams in the next few years. And these D-League players have very little chance of being able to make it up there. And you know, in minor leagues, I feel like the minor leagues are so part of the team systems that they know exactly what they're doing. In the NBA, a lot of teams share them. I know there's one D-League team, I think that's six affiliates. And it's a little, you know, it's a little interesting. And you are listening to KWUR Clayton 90.3 FM, and we're finishing up our talk about the NBA. I have another topic that I thought would be interesting to go ahead with. I know Dr. Jeff's listening, and he told us to, you know, get onto that draft wheel. We were at, you know, the Sloan Sports Conference, Dr. Jeff and I, this past weekend, and we saw Mike Zarin, and he, you know, part of the Celtics organization, and it was found out that he was the one behind the draft wheel proposition that would be part of what the Celtics or what the NBA would do around 2020. I think would be around the earliest. I think it was 2019 that they wanted to institute it, because I think that's when the last time the draft picks were traded or sent around. But what would you think about a draft wheel in which every team would know exactly when their draft position would be every year, instead of having these teams that actually try to lose? And the counter argument would be that tanking, it's a risky thing. You can't instill a losing situation in a city, because that really doesn't help your team going forward. Are the players going to be there going forward? Is your coach going to be coaching your team moving forward? Where are these angles that you want to approach it with, and what do you think as far as the draft field goes, and is that a good idea to have it scripted instead of the draft order with a lottery and with the season's end and what their records are?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one alternative is just not having the lottery like it is in the NFL. Hmm. So that the team with the worst record, you know, we know it's going to go in the order that they finish.
And you really want to tank, right?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, we had this sort of movement a couple of years ago with Andrew Luck, where there was this feeling that teams were out of any playoff contention were playing their backups for that purpose. You know, and that would be more transparent and less interesting. The problem with the lottery is, you know, you could have you know, you've got a history of a team in the Western Conference that might have just missed the playoffs despite being a pretty good team and a contender because of, let's say, injuries. coming up with great picks, like, for example, when the San Antonio Spurs, after getting David Robinson 2 years later, got Tim Duncan, were able to build the foundations for a dynasty, or at least an interrupted dynasty, based on luck with the lottery. Then a similar situation when Orlando, and they couldn't hang on to any of these great pieces, but they drafted Shaquille O'Neal, missed the playoffs by like percentage points with the same record, and then got a superstar point guard in Anthony Hardaway, and then immediately made it into the finals. Unfortunately, they couldn't keep that team together. Who knows what they would have done if they kept that team together with the other nice pieces of Horace Grant from the Bulls, Dennis Scott, and Nick Anderson. It was just a really, really interesting young group that they had, and then they all fell apart and went their separate ways. There's pros and cons of each approach. I wouldn't have a huge problem getting rid of the lottery altogether. We all know this. If you saw this week's issue of ESPN, the magazine, they treated NBA conspiracy theories like an alien invasion conspiracy theory, and you know, brought up one of the most famous NBA conspiracy theories, which I lived through and heard about it before, during, after, and it's never gone away. The idea that the 1985 NBA lottery was rigged with a frozen envelope to ensure that the Knicks got Patrick Ewing so that they could revitalize that franchise. I've never heard anybody seriously try to prove that it was right or wrong, and it's just one of those things. You know, other scandals like the Black Sox scandal of 1919, people went to jail for. We still have a lot of our contemporary fiction addresses those events. So I wouldn't mind getting rid of the lottery altogether. It just makes for a lot of excitement. Sometimes the lottery picks like Danny Manning turn out not to really be impact players. Sometimes they turn out to be Tim Duncan or LeBron James. So.
Very interesting. Yeah, there's so many different parts of these lotteries that people remember, even the Cavaliers kind of just completely shanking their pick this past year with Anthony Bennett. And I think he has still one double-double in his entire NBA career thus far. And they were trying to find him some minutes, and he's basically been maybe one of the worst ever. I always remember Michael Candy, even though I think he actually made an impact when he was early on in his career, but he was always that journeyman like Joe Smith near the end of his career. But there's always those fun ones just you think about. And it's always it's a crapshoot, really, because you're looking at, especially now, one-year players that haven't been developed much, that are just playing on raw talent, that the AAU players. So it's a lottery in itself twice. Once with the actual picking of the lottery balls, and then the once with the picking of the actual player. Is he in the right system? Can he do that? But yeah, is it worth it enough to completely change the system, not allow any trading of picks past 2019, and go into this type of draft wheel? I'm not sure it's worth it now that I think about it. The reason why I think of the positives to it is because it's a kind of a change of pace. It's a fun change. It's entertainment. And they want to make it even more fun. And I think that would actually be a fun spin. But then after a while, it would get old. So there's a lot of positive and negatives. You're absolutely right to that situation. I actually was thinking about another NBA topic recently. I was at Dr. Charles Schizler. Schizler was talking at the Sloan Sports Conference about sleep studies in the NBA. And he brought back this old story of Doc Rivers and working with him during the 2010-2011 NBA season. And he was talking about how sleep is going to be a huge part of the NBA going forward. And there was one instance in which he actually was able to predict when the Celtics were going to lose based on their schedule. And this is why Dr. Schizler wants to get rid of road back-to-backs in the NBA. Is that something that you think that should be just eradicated? Because these players are just being put on such a duress, and your reaction time is tripled. It is three times as worse. After all these studies and everything that he did, found out that the three times is worse when you basically miss a night of sleep. So if they're on just a few hours taking a red eye from, say, Phoenix to Portland, wherever, they have to react, and they have to take a chance at sitting some guys like Popovich has done. That's a great idea. The problem is, why are you doing that as a league that wants to have 82-game seasons and have every game for the fans? So do you think that they should get rid of road back-to-backs just going forward?
Well, I haven't read Dr. Chidla's study, but I do have personal knowledge of what happens when you're denied sleep. We have a lot of focus in the health community about obesity, especially childhood obesity now. And the next big issue is everyone not getting enough sleep. It goes beyond. It's certainly not unique to athletics. So we know that if you're working and somebody interrupts you, that the average person, it can take them several minutes to get back to the point in time where the cognitive level where they were before they can work again. And you know, for people for whom time is money, or in the case of professional athletes, time is points, you know, that can be a big problem. I don't know that one study is enough to do it, but if I my personal knowledge of the effects of lack of sleep are consistent with the study's conclusion, and you know, if it's borne out, I would favor the elimination of back-to-back road games, not just for the NBA, but for the NHL, and this might even play to, I know Dr. Jeff hates the Sunday games followed by the Thursday night games. They have to prepare for a second game so quickly, and sometimes travel, that certainly the coaching staff has their sleep affected. And one thing we've spoken about before is possibly eliminating the Thursday night games unless it follows a bye week, and that's for the NFL. So baseball, you know, they're kind of sleeping in the outfield sometimes anyway, so I'm not sure it's as much of an issue. You know, and they've got 162 games, and we keep adding playoff levels of playoff rounds every generation. So it doesn't seem to be as urgent an issue for the Major League Baseball. Yep. But generally, if it's borne out by further evidence, I would agree with that proposal by Dr. Chidla.
Yeah, it makes sense. It just does. In baseball, yeah, you could play 200 games if you wanted to. It seems like it'd be all right, except for some of those hard-throwing pitchers. As far as going forward, yeah, let's get rid of them. And then, it's, you know, just a little thing on that NFL, yeah. Definitely need a bye week. I know they do that for London. When the guys come back, they always have a bye week for that team waiting for them when they return from overseas, which makes complete sense. And I just can't imagine them adding 2 weeks. I can't imagine them playing on other days, but it seems like they want to add a football game almost every day of the week. But doesn't that become a situation in which, and this is why the Thursday games are now feel oversaturated as well, or the league feels oversaturated with their games towards their fans. I'm not a big fan of the Thursday night games that often. I just don't know. It kind of takes away. There's sometimes a terrible schedule on Sunday. I think there were five or so weeks this past season that I just didn't find a game that I actually really wanted to watch. So with the exception of your home team, you're really trying to find something when you get taken away at least one or two games when they'd either have the Saturday games late in the season or the Thursday games, I think, every week. But, of course, TV and money, and they always get always so much for it, and the NFL rules all. So I'm sure they're doing it right as far as what they can do for their bankrolls, and I'm going to guess they'll just keep doing that until they really get sued again by the players.
Yeah, like everything else, it's all about revenue. You only have in a big market five games on national television in a typical week, plus any Thursday night games. And so, if you have two Thursday night games, you're adding, you know, having seven games on national television a week. Fans who want to see all games get the NFL Network, so they can see all games. But obviously, they make a lot more revenue by having them on national television.
Oh, definitely in the red zone, of course. Oh man, that's big. I know Dr. Jeff was able to get that for this season, and it was nuts seeing all that stuff. They always do this fun kickoff thing right at the beginning of the week. Or at the beginning of the Sunday games, they gave you every kickoff right after one another. It's just kind of nice start to the day when you get to watch all those touchdowns on that channel there.
Yeah.
So yeah, as far as the rest of the show goes, we'll get to what up with that after the next public service announcement.
If someone you know is thinking of dropping out, talk to them. It could be the one thing that keeps them going. Go to boostup.org to learn more. Brought to you by the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
What up with you? Taking on the issues of today with soul.
Yeah. I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Got a big old box of popcorn to clear my head. Went to the theater and down I sat. We're going to the movies with my favorite that movie. What's up with that?
I always enjoy that. What's up with that music? SNL, I don't know if they're going to be doing it that much. I don't think I've seen it in a while, but always fun to have What Up With That on Bedtime Sports today. And the first one is about Wichita State. You know, we're going into the NCAA tournament. We're already in March. We actually have the D3 tournament here tonight at Washington University. We'll be kicking it off the first round of the Division III NCAA tournament. We actually play back-to-back games, which is kind of nuts after talking about the back-to-back games that we were talking about in the last segment. But they are in the same place. They will be the same place. That makes it a little better. But for D1, Wichita State, 31-0 regular season. First team since St. Joseph's in 2004 to go undefeated in a regular season. They did it. They finished it off with a 68-45 win over Missouri State this past week. What up with that, Milo?
Well, Wichita State, everybody has a pretty short memory and forgets that they made it to the Final Four last year. If you look at their record, they did play early in the season in their pre-conference games. Not the greatest powers, but they played some what you would call Big Six major conference teams and beat all of them. I think that what we're seeing with Wichita State is simply the growth of the next middle major power. In the past, we've had the examples, and people had the same reaction when teams like Gonzaga and Xavier and Butler first got far into the tournament. You remember, Butler actually made it to the final, the little middle major that could. So we just might be seeing the growth of Wichita State into that kind of a team. It's great for the city of Wichita and Kansas, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy as they're able to recruit the next group of freshmen better than they better group than they did before. So I think what's up is that you've got a legitimate contender. As to whether or not they should be a number one seed, hey, if they finish their conference tournament and they're still undefeated, yeah, they should be a number one seed. I wouldn't be shocked if they lost in the Sweet 16. My prediction would be that they'll get to the Elite Eight and maybe fall short of the Final Four. But give credit where credit's due. Every other team came out and had a bad night. They get some props for never having a bad night.
Oh, absolutely. And the funniest thing is that they're still, they're ranked number two behind Florida with two losses. And, okay, that definitely given them some pretty good credence for what they did this season. It's just weird seeing teams like Duke with six losses and teams like Virginia with five losses being in the top five. And then Wichita State, sneaking its way up and being able to keep that undefeated season going. I'm just surprised they aren't already in a major conference, because once they do well, don't the major conference just want to scoop them up right away? But, we'll see what happens going forward. But hopefully they keep it going and keep undefeated, because, when they play angry, and that's sort of been their motto now, it's just a lot. They have T-shirts. They have everything. It's basically, I guess, play angry might be like everything that they just say to each other at Wichita. So it's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah. So, they're certainly living up to their nickname of the Shockers.
Yes.
I mean, how perfect is that? So just some higher profile teams that they beat that people forget about. They beat BYU, they beat Tennessee, they beat Alabama.
St. Louis, and, pretty good team.
So those are certainly respectable SEC I guess BYU is still Mountain West, if I'm not mistaken.
That
but people forget that they
Conference.
Had those games. West Coast Conference,
yep.
And people forget that they had those games and they showed up and brought their best and pulled off the win. They beat Alabama 72-67. They beat Tennessee a little bit more margin, 70-61. They beat Brigham Young 75-62. So they find a way to win these games, and you have to give them respect, and they deserve a number one seed if they can come through the MVC tournament remaining undefeated.
They start
off that tournament with Evansville. So, you know, obviously if they lose to a team in their tournament, that knocks them down almost definitely out of a number one seed. But even if they don't win the conference, they should be in the tournament and 12 or higher, just I would say 6 or higher just on the basis of the regular season record.
The great thing about the MVC, the Missouri Valley Conference, is they play their conference tournament at the Scott Trade Center. Right down the street here in St. Louis. And the Scott Trade Center will be hosting the NCAA tournament a few weeks later. So we'll see if Wichita ends up getting if they get lucky and get the overall number one seed, they might be here playing their first few games where they'll actually stay. Be very interesting to see if that happens. But just a lot of great things going on with Wichita, and hopefully they'll be able to make it back to Final Four again. We have.
Yeah, so are any of those events happening the weekend of May 15 by any chance?
Did you say May 15th or March 15th?
I'm sorry. No, May 15th. Oh, no, it wouldn't be May 15th. That's a couple of months off.
I think you can catch a Cards game.
March Madness would definitely be over by May. And I was going to say it's too bad we don't know anybody who has a good way of getting tickets for any of these events.
You might be... We might be able to see if we can do like a bedtime sports thing also with the NCAA tournament. We'll definitely keep you guys on tabs with that, and we'll move on to our next one up with that. We have the New York Rangers, another team right in your backyard there, Milo. They were pretty busy at the NHL trade deadline. They acquired 6-time All-Star Martin St. Louis, who I love when people read his name and they think he's actually with the Blues. But they got him from the Tampa Bay Lightning in exchange for Ryan Callahan mm-hmm. and draft picks. I heard that everybody was kind of mad where a lot of people were mad that Ryan Callahan is out of New York. You know, what up with that?
Yeah. So there was a lot of buzz that if they trade Brian Callahan, Ryan Callahan, that's the heart and soul of the team. He is a captain. He's a team leader. He was a lot of what had what formed the glue and the cohesiveness of the on the ice unit. Martin St. Louis is a great player. He might be a top 12 all-star in the league. The only thing that's makes sense about this is that they were engaged in his contract was expiring, and if they didn't trade him, he would be able to walk, and they would get nothing for him. So it doesn't seem like a terrible deal for the Rangers because they might have lost him for nothing. And in the meantime, they've got Martin St. Louis, who could help them with a playoff run. Rangers will likely make the playoffs. I would think they're capable, if they come up with the number 6 seed, of getting to the second round. I don't see them going too much farther than that. Again, our worst team ownership in sports history, the Dolans, will at least cut some of their losses if the Rangers make the playoffs and they get a home playoff round. But what makes the trade a bad trade is that they gave up draft picks.
Yes, of course.
And those will come back to haunt them. We'll see some of those draft picks be extremely valuable players that the Rangers would have loved to have had. But because they were having a hard time re-signing Callahan and he could have walked for nothing, it's not the worst trade in the world. St. Louis is still a very good player who can make a major contribution. There's a long history of NHL players contributing into their 40s. The best example for the Rangers got tremendous production out of Mike Gartner in the glory years. One of the highest goal scorers of all time. He was supposed to be over the hill when they traded Ulf Dahlin for him in 1992.
What a name.
and turned out to be, one of the rare exceptions where the Rangers made a great trade. I shouldn't say that. They traded for Mark Messier too. So that was the best trade in their history. It remains to be seen how that works out. This could work out better for both sides.
Very interesting.
If I could pipe in before we run out of time, because I don't want to let our time expire without bringing up what I wanted to talk about. I want to give all of our listeners a little bit of a lesson in how sports can play, or sports figures can play very heavily into current events.
Interesting.
We've turned on to the real news in the last couple of weeks and turned away from the entertainment news that floods the morning shows. We've seen that there's a huge crisis in the Ukraine with transition of power and the president being kicked out and Russia invading and trying to secure the Crimean Peninsula for their own interests and creating an international crisis. Now, there's been really, I think, three figures in boxing history who have really affected the course of American and even world history. One of them is Muhammad Ali, who declined to go into the draft, was stripped of his heavyweight championship, took his case up to the Supreme Court, and was found to have been unconstitutionally denied his right to make a living and change the law, and has been a figure because of his conversion to Muslim, that really affected our entire world culture. The second one isn't known for being a boxer. Was Nelson Mandela, who was a professional boxer
really?
Before he was a civil rights leader. Yeah, he was,
wow.
And not a bad one either. He competed as a middleweight.
Cool.
So obviously he's one of a figure who changed the world. And how does what I said about the Ukraine come into this? The leader of the opposition in the resistance that helped run the corrupt Viktor Yanukovych out of power is the heavyweight he's actually heavyweight champion emeritus Vitali Klitschko, 6'7", left to become a member of parliament and lead the opposition while still holding his heavyweight title. His only losses in his entire career were because of injuries in the middle of the fight. He was never beaten in a decision, never knocked out. Quite frankly, his life is in a lot of danger now. He's certainly not bulletproof. But you can imagine as he was successfully in the early stages of this, talked down certain riots, he would be quite a sight if you want to see someone negotiating with Vladimir Putin, a former KGB colonel who could actually have a physical effect of looking intimidating next to Vladimir Putin.
Wow.
If anybody to it, it could be Vitali Klitschko. He's also he's going to be running for president at the end of March, maybe it's longer than that. I don't think he's favored to win, but there has never. Other than Nelson Mandela, never been there's never been a world champion boxer who's become a head of state, as far as I know. And this would be quite an interesting sports figure transition, making himself much more important than all of sports.
Wow, that's a lot right there for Milo. I was not expecting that much of just a huge sports take that involved the world that came with everything. Oh man, what a great way to put the show on a final note there. What I wanted to say was I wanted to channel my inner Cosmo Kramer and talk about the Ukraine. The Ukraine is weak. It's feeble. I think it's going to time to put the hurt on the Ukraine. So.
Yeah, well, I got news for you, Stats. My ancestors, Milo Papadopoulos' ancestors that didn't come from Greece, a lot of them came from Ukraine, and so did yours. So It's one of those one of those interesting examples where you look at a place where your ancestors came from being in chaos, and you know, when wow. when you look at a place like Syria or Somalia, that might not be the case, but it is with Ukraine. So on that note, to put make sports affect the real world.
Yes.
Since I think sports can be, you know, the same kind of obsession that people who are not into it don't understand the way that we don't understand, some obsessions of our better halves, such as celebrity gossip and shoes. kind of put how it can translate into things that really affect a lot of people, besides just the economic benefits of professional sports and college sports.
Wow, what a great show, Milo. Thank you very much for being a part of it. I have one last line then from that Seinfeld episode. I guess since we are Ukrainian, I guess we'll talk about the Ukrainian response. Ukrainian is game to you. How about I take your little board and smash it to pieces? He just destroys the whole risk for it. So yeah. There we go.
How many people didn't even know that Ukraine was could be considered an independent country until they played Risk if they grew up, before the collapse of the Soviet Union.
My first month here at Washington University, I played Risk. I saw the Ukraine. It was what a learning moment that was. Oh, what a great show, Milo. Thank you again for joining me. And
thank you for having me.
Of course.
It was a pleasure.
Oh, man. Yeah, and I hope everybody has a great week and enjoy everything, your last week before March Madness, or at least D1 March Madness. Enjoy D3 March Madness. So everybody have a great week. Bye.
Bye-bye.